The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I'm here again this week on the News Dissector radio program, an extension of the blog I write at newsdissector.com. I'm here to discuss some of the vital issues of our times, as I do every week at this time here on the Progressive Radio Network.com. You can join us on the call-in line at 888-874-4888. That's the free number to call if you want to join this conversation today. What's in the news? What's been in the news for weeks? Libya, one of the big crises and perhaps one of the worst reported stories that we've seen for some time now. This is the crisis of supposed rebellion, uprising, the fall of Gaddafi, the so-called freedom of Libya, but we really don't know a lot about it. One of the people who's been following this closely is Phyllis Banis of the Institute of Policy Studies. She knows a lot about the Middle East. She writes a lot about the Middle East, and she speaks out about the Middle East. She's extremely articulate. She's someone who I always stop to listen to whenever I can hear her voice, because she's very well informed. And she'll be with us in a minute, as will a fellow named Fred Wilcox from Ithaca College up in Ithaca, New York, who's written a powerful, powerful book of the legacy of war, in this case, the legacy of the chemical war in Vietnam, the use of Agent Orange there, which continues to basically create an ecocide, a destruction of the environment, a destruction of the people who are exposed to this herbicide that was supposed to be safe, but in fact has created a disaster, a catastrophe after the war that we're still dealing with 50 years after Agent Orange was first dropped in Indochina. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here. Stay with us. Edwin Starr, war, what is it good for? The answer, in his words, absolutely nothing. What about your words, Phyllis Banis? What do you think about the situation in Libya? We're you know, reading about it, we're seeing it on TV, but are we getting the full story?
Hey, Danny, thanks. It's good to be with you. No, we're not getting the full story, and I certainly don't claim I can have the full story. I don't think anybody individually has the full story, but there's parts of the full story that we know that are not getting talked about very much. And one is, and it's been particularly strong, I think, in this last week or so, when the fighting in and around Tripoli has really escalated, and that is the significance of the military role that NATO and the U.S. are playing in this fight. It's a very complicated thing, you know, Danny, because the reality is that the Libyan uprising did emerge in the context of the Arab Spring, what came to be called the Arab Spring, in the neighborhood. And on both sides of it, Egypt on one side, Tunisia on the other, there had been these successful revolutionary processes underway that had overthrown longstanding dictators and had brought into political motion wide sectors of the society, nonviolently and with incredible mobilization. Incredible problems remain, and I don't think we're not even close to saying that there's been a complete victory for democracy and equality and all those things that we like to talk about in either one of those countries, but it was an amazing victory in the overthrow of these long-standing dictatorships. In Libya, it was different. There was the same kind of uprising against a dictatorship, which by that time had been in the pocket of the West for a good 5 years, after a long time of not being there. And suddenly the big difference emerged when the decision was made by the Libyan opposition to take up arms very quickly. And one can argue, I argued at various points, that some of the points that had to do with NATO's involvement were not, there was no evidence, but people on the ground said we had no choice. And I'm certainly not going to be in a position to say they were wrong. But there are consequences. Right or wrong, there's consequences to those actions. And one of the consequences was a very rapid escalation from the people taking up arms that they took from the regime, captured from the regime, etc., to the invitation and the credibility that they gave to NATO and the U.S. for direct military intervention under the terms of a U.N. resolution.
No, we have
that
to really,
changes everything.
You're absolutely right, and we have to remind people, because I think this is significant, there is a difference between a rebellion, an uprising, an a locally organized effort to express dissatisfaction, dissent, anger at a regime, you know, a desire to overthrow that regime, and certainly there were people in Libya who felt that desire very strongly. On the other hand, it's also true that this wouldn't have happened the way it's happening, certainly, if we didn't have, you know, six months now of bombing by NATO in the name of protecting civilians. In other words, this was invoked and got support around the world as a humanitarian intervention to protect people.
Right.
And it was turned into basically the NATO becoming the air force of these insurgents or rebels or whoever they actually are, because there's a lot of dispute and debate about that, too, about what this force is.
Well,
and,
you know, that's one of the interesting things that we're facing here, Danny. And the question arose also in Egypt. It also arose in Tunisia. It also arose in Bahrain and in Syria. Everywhere there has been a rising against a dictatorship in this context of the Arab Spring, the question has quickly emerged, well, who are these rebels anyway? And why should, you know, a lot of skepticism, a lot of unease. And the reality is in every one of these cases, and Libya in this sense is not different, they have been composed of a wide range of political forces that are very diverse and don't agree on very much.
One of the observations you made, Phyllis, in your article, which I think has been published on a lot of different websites. I don't know if you can give us
Al-Jazeera,
a reference to it.
Alternate
Al Jazeera. Right. You know, Phyllis Bannis's piece about, you know, this isn't over yet. Analysis. One of the observations you made is that, unlike in Egypt, or even Tunisia, we're seeing very few women on the front lines of all of this.
Well, I think that that's in what I was speaking to there was the question particularly of the celebrations on the streets of Tripoli, which happened after the rebel forces entered the city from the mountains. They came down from the mountains into the city, meeting very little resistance, largely because there had been an intensive set of bombing raids by NATO, led by the U.S., with intelligence from drones, etc., that had wiped out the capacity of the regime to respond militarily. They came down from the mountains, entered the city, and it was in that context that celebratory demonstrations in the streets of Tripoli began. What I was pointing out there is that those celebrations did not appear to be made up of the population as a whole. They appeared to be made up of the armed rebels
who came from outside
the city, from outside, but they were armed men. They were not including women. They did not include old people or children. This was not families celebrating. Now, that may have changed at a later point, but in those early protests, I think that the issue about women's involvement was not so much, and I hope it wasn't taken as a claim that I would be making, which I was not, that these rebels are necessarily people who exclude women and who believe in extremist views about the exclusion of women from public life. That was not my point. My point was that the celebrations were being carried out only by the armed rebels themselves, which means young men. Some older men, perhaps.
It also seems to be the case, and I could be wrong about this. Obviously, it's a fluid situation. I'm not there, and neither are you, observing all of this. But there does seem to be confusion about who the rebels are or the different factions among the rebels, so-called
right.
tribal groups or whatever.
Right.
Early in the conflict, Pajamas Media, conservative outlet, carried an article basically showing that there was a great deal of confusion. concern. One out of five, they said, people who are considered themselves rebels also considered Gaddafi to be Jewish.
I would not take very seriously Pajamas Radio Pajamas Media. Well,
I'm only saying this was.
You're right, though.
This was echoed on NBC. It wasn't just Pajamas Media,
but there certainly is a. There's a lot of questions, and I think that. Again, like in the other places, the rebel forces in Libya represent a wide range of views. I think what's important is two points around that. One is that there were accusations made early on, ironically, first by Gaddafi, and then versions of them accepted in certain ways by others that said that the rebels were all either Islamists or westernized, meaning drug-addicted young people. Obviously, neither of those were completely true, but what was true was that it did include a sector of Islamists who have always had a presence in Libya, and it did include a number of young, modernizing forces in Libya that were very parallel to those young leaders of the Tahrir Square uprising in Egypt.
I read a report, Phyllis, that basically said that Benghazi was a base for what al-Qaeda sympathetic groups existed in Libya, which was sort of ironic
to
me.
Right, but Benghazi is a huge city. It's the second largest city in the country, and there's lots of people there. And I have no doubt that there are extremist Islamist forces in some numbers, but there's no particular indications I've seen from anything that I would consider very reliable that they are among the key leadership of the uprising. I think there are Islamist elements in the Transitional National Council. As worrying as that, I think, is the fact that there are elements who came directly out of the highest levels of the Gaddafi regime itself and have now transferred their loyalty to the rebel side, and, crucially, some who were living for many years in exile in circumstances that make it very likely, if not absolutely 100% sure, that they were allied with the CIA.
I would just report that this morning, you know, one of the battles or political discussions, debates within this whole situation has been the stand of South Africa. South Africa, the largest, most influential, not the largest country in Africa, but certainly one of the most influential countries in Africa, supported the UN resolution. Then said,
right,
we didn't support the idea of, we supported protecting people, protecting their human rights, not using NATO army, NATO Air Force to bomb civilians.
Right.
And up until the last minute, South Africa has been attempting to stop the NATO bombing in Libya unsuccessfully. Last night, the UN Security Council released $1.5 billion of seized Libyan assets to be used for emergency aid after the U.S. and South Africa ended a dispute over the money. This is
which basically meant that South Africa gave in to the U.S. pressure to allow the money to be released, mostly under the control of the TNC. Now, that's very problematic. Not all of it will go, none of it will go directly to the TNC.
But
it's
divided
into thirds, and one-third will be controlled by the UN to be used for the UN agencies that are already in operation there, the humanitarian agencies. Another third will be remaining under U.S. control, which is very unnerving, through the TNC, to help in things like paying salaries and restarting the electrical systems, et cetera, which is one of those things that sort of sounds good. That's what's always needed after a conflict situation. But it goes directly to the question of control. And when you have a scenario where the choice is between continuing to hold money that belongs to the Libyan people, which, of course, the U.S. should not be in any position to be holding on to that money. But the alternative to that is, from if you look at the U.S. choice that they're describing, it's either that or turn it over to the Transitional National Council, which is a self-appointed rebel group, which some rebels have been very clear they do not believe to be their legitimate leader. There
right,
was a,
right. This is important. Also, South Africa's UN ambassador has said that the African Union, in a summit in Ethiopia, has approved its accord with the United States. However, the whole question of whether the African Union really had any independent role or was allowed any independent role to play is something that's a big debate.
One of the challenges that we had here was that there was, from the beginning, I think, a hope that some combination of the United Nations, the Arab League, and the African Union would be able to play a mediating role in the Libya conflict to avoid the complete militarization, which is, of course, what happened quite rapidly when the involvement of NATO was approved.
Yes, South
and
Africa.
The problem we faced, well, let me just finish. Yeah. The problem we faced was that on the part of the UN, they had essentially abandoned a credible role in peacemaking by endorsing the use of force by NATO, by outsourcing the use of force to another agency, didn't take away their obligation, their responsibility for embracing that force.
Well,
on the part of the two regional organizations, the African Union and the Arab League, they both faced kind of opposing challenges to their legitimacy. The Arab League was seen as illegitimate because in its meetings, the Saudis had controlled the situation, had invited only half the 22 members of the Arab League, and so the widely touted endorsement of the Arab League vote, which was about 10 to 1 in favor of endorsing the UN resolution supporting the use of force, only reflected the views of about half of the Arab League, and those included mainly those who already supported the Saudi and U.S. positions. The African Union's legitimacy was challenged because it was historically viewed as being in Gaddafi's pocket. He had long put huge amounts of money into African countries starting about a decade ago when the Arab League essentially turned against Gaddafi for a host of internal political reasons. He turned to the African identity of Libya, poured money into a number of African countries, some of which did in fact get used well for roads, for infrastructure, for clinics and schools, but much of which ended up in the pocket of corrupt Arab officials.
African officials
in that scenario. So all of these agencies were viewed with great skepticism. My own view was that the best possibility might have been a joint diplomatic initiative that could be taken by the African Union and the Arab League together, kind of canceling out their ambiguous legitimacy problems, but that never emerged.
Well, I would just say I was in South Africa at the beginning of the summer. I was there for 6 weeks, Phyllis, and this issue was very much present in the South African press and on the radio. There was a great deal of frustration among people in the ANC at the grassroots level, who, of course, have fought their own revolution, if you want to call it that.
And great opposition to their government's position.
Against apartheid, who were very disappointed with the Zuma government's endorsement of this NATO action. And then to try to make it right, Zuma then made these various trips to Russia, to Libya, to try to see if he could get NATO to stop bombing, and of course NATO told him to go stuff it. So, we're in a situation where Africa's influence actually shrank, and there's a lot of people on the African continent very upset about that. At the same time, there's a debate about the legitimacy of this rebellion and revolution, the questions you've been raising, which are very complex. Juan Cole, who of course is a Middle East scholar from Michigan, has written that the Libyan revolution has largely succeeded, and this is a moment of celebration not only for Libyans but for a youth generation in the Arab world that has pursued a political opening across the region. The secret of the uprising's final days of success lay in a popular revolt in the working class districts of the capital, which did most of the hard work of throwing off the rule of the secret police and military clique. So this view sort of conflicts a little bit with the one that you're giving us.
Yeah, Juan and I have gone back and forth on some of this from the beginning of the uprising in Libya. He and I had a very public dispute. He wrote a long paper essentially saying that the NATO engagement, the NATO intervention, was right and was justified. And I wrote a long response to Juan Cole publicly challenging. I have enormous respect for his work. I don't agree with his conclusions. I think that he's right that there was enormous bravery from people in many districts of Tripoli that stood up against the secret police and the intelligence agencies that had long been holding such tight control over people's lives in Libya. That happened fairly late in the game, and that's not surprising, given the challenges that that regime posed to people organizing. There were underground cells. But I think to say that they did much of the heavy lifting really is only half the story. They sacrificed a great deal. They were very brave. I'm not challenging any of that. What I do think is that it took place in the context of having the NATO Air Force acting as the Air Force for the rebels, which has consequences. Again, it's not up to people like you and me, Danny, to sit here, or for Juan, to sit here in the U.S. and pass judgment on whether they're good revolutionaries or bad revolutionaries, but it is to analyze what the consequences are of their actions. And in this case, one of the consequences of having NATO and the U.S. as your Air Force is that, yeah, certain military things become possible that would not have been possible.
Well, absolutely.
But at the same time, it was also true that without this level of militarization from the beginning, we might not have seen Libya devolve into a civil war. And in the immediate thing that Juan is speaking of in his recent piece, I think it leaves out the role of NATO in the undermining and ultimately, as far as we can tell now, it's almost happening, the destruction of the regime in its control of Tripoli.
I don't think it's just a military role either. There's a great deal of political assets, political
Absolutely.
Mobilization, intervention, CIA, covert
that
action
continues.
That hasn't
that's
been
what
reported.
Continues after the war.
You know, Tripoli Post, which I can access on my iPad, an English-language newspaper in Tripoli, Libya, is reporting today that Jalloud plans role in future Libyan government and will form a political party. He was the prime minister and the aide under Gaddafi of the 1st of September revolution in Libya. So you have a lot of people who worked with Gaddafi who are coming back to play some role or want to play some role in all of this. Meanwhile,
well,
the focus...
Of them, the leadership of the... Transitional National Council itself is the former justice minister under Gaddafi.
So may I just continue here with these reports, because the other aspect of this that's it seems like the United States and NATO forces and encouraging the Libyans basically to kill Gaddafi as soon as they possibly can. And he's being urged to surrender to prevent further bloodshed. However, at the same time, a lot of money has been placed on his head, and we could expect perhaps a bin Laden type ending for Gaddafi if they have the capacity to do it. And it seems like that's where this is going. Kill him,
well,
get him out of the way.
I do think, though, it's important that we recognize, what you and I were just talking about a minute ago, Danny, the notion that there are a lot of the people that are involved in the leadership of the rebel forces and those who are coming back and will claim new positions. Many of them were indeed key figures within the regime. They were supporters of the regime. I do think there's a contradiction here. On the one hand, issues of accountability become very important in changing history, in preventing dictatorships from reemerging somewhere else or in the same places. On the other hand, when you have a country like Libya, where the very unusual, very, in my view, very strange governing system was one that did not allow independent institutions, an independent judiciary, any kind of a parliament. It was very much a one-man or one-family show. In that context, it means that pretty much everybody is going to have some connection to the regime. And while you do need to hold people accountable for crimes, for human rights violations, etc., on all sides, at every point, you also have to recognize that the fact that people were part of a regime when it was the only thing that existed in the country, has to be taken into account as well. It's not an excuse. It doesn't mean people are not accountable for what they did militarily in police agencies, torture, assassinations, arrests, political arrests, all of those things. People do need to be held accountable. But we also need to acknowledge that lots of people who were supporters who were open supporters were supporters because that was what you needed to do to get a job, to get your kid into college, to get medical care.
There's one other issue, Phyllis, before we go. This is a fascinating discussion, and we probably should have taken the whole hour, but I have a bunch of other guests coming on. I just wanted to close with this, the one word we haven't used yet in our conversation. It's a small word. It's a short word, oil. Libya has what's called sweet oil, which is a special type of oil that's used in the refining of all oil. It's something very desirable for Western nations, and it's something that is at issue now. What is going to happen to the oil in Libya? Who's going to get it? The New York Times is reporting a scramble is underway.
Already partly been answered. The head of the Transitional National Council, when he gave his widely publicized press conference yesterday, he said explicitly that he thanked the international community as a whole, and then said that those who provided particular assistance to us will be rewarded. He was very explicit. And what that means is the oil companies of countries that supported the rebel side are going to get the privileged access to contracts. I mean, the irony, of course, of this whole war is that this was not the war for oil in the way that we sometimes understand it, in the sense that Gaddafi and the Libyan oil institutions were very much in bed with the West already.
Right, exactly.
So it wasn't something that they didn't
have
access to.
Well, the one new factor,
control.
I think the one new factor here that we've been reading about of late is the role Turkey has played in not only providing money and assistance, but also being very helpful to the new government, the new emerging government.
It's played a very important role.
The new emerging government in Libya. Phyllis Menes, thank you so much for joining us this morning at the last minute to be with us on this program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you'll come back and we can bat this around some more, not just this, because another war is coming on very fast, the one in Yemen, where the United States is escalating its intervention, and there's more to come. And in fact, war is something that's with us all over, and in a sense for all time, because when wars end, they don't always just end, as we'll find out in a few minutes when we talk about scorched earth, the legacies of chemical warfare in Vietnam. Vietnam, Vietnam. Remember this song? This is, of course, Bruce Springsteen singing Born in the USA, but it's a song really about the Vietnam War. Going to continue our discussion about war in a minute, scorched earth. But here in New York City, where everyone is battening down the hatches, waiting for Hurricane Irene to strike, possibly on Sunday, flashlights are sold out in many stores in the city. People are preparing there for an emergency. Another emergency has been going on in this city that has gone largely unattended to, and that is the emergency of foreclosure, of people being thrown out of their homes. And many of them not being able to get the help from the Obama administration or the city government or anybody to try to stop evictions that were prompted by people taking mortgages that were fraudulent on the face of it. They didn't know it, and they ended up basically losing their homes. There is, however, and before we go to our discussion of Agent Orange, there's a Shiro in our midst, a woman who has stood up against eviction in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. Our friend Green Arrow has hooked us up with her. She's 82 years old. Her name is Mary Lee Ward, and she's fighting an illegal eviction. Now, what's making this significant and new is that people in her community are fighting with her, are standing up for her, are actually mobilizing in the streets, and are trying to stop this eviction. She's 82. You wouldn't have heard about her or heard from her, but because the community has come out the way it has, some state reps have come out on her behalf. She has a very talented lawyer working for her, and she is fighting this eviction. We wanted to pay our respects to her, and we wanted you to know about her. Her name, again, is Mary Lee Ward. She's 82, and she's here on the radio here with us. Hello, Ms. Ward. How are you?
Hi, this is Karen. This is her attorney. I'm going to give her the phone right now. Ms. Ward, can you say hello to everyone?
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody.
Hey, how are you? I'm so happy you could join us. Just tell us what's going on in your fight in Brooklyn to keep your home.
Ms. Ward, can you tell them about the fight here in Brooklyn to keep your home?
Yes. Hello, I can't.
That's okay. Just keep talking.
Oh, yes, I appreciate you coming to my rescue. There's a rally here on Wednesday to assist me to continue to stay in my home. And
this is Karen. Can I give you some details about the rally?
Yeah, please. I understand that Ms. Ward may not be, you know, a practice radio host, you know, but we're so happy just to hear her voice and know that she has stood up where so many others have been basically so depressed by their situations that they were unable to fight back. Please tell us about it, Karen.
On August 19th, we had 250 people outside our house ready to be arrested, that they would get arrested before Ms. Ward got evicted. And I think it was the first time in New York City that we've seen a human shield, people putting their bodies on the line to prevent an eviction because of foreclosure. And so our next step is to rally on Wednesday at 4 p.m. outside Ms. Ward's house, and we're going to have a march. At 4 p.m. outside of 320 Tompkins Avenue, Tompkins and Gates. And this march is really a call of support to the Attorney General.
That's in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, is that correct?
You got it.
So,
right. And so our Attorney General is the only Attorney General, actually himself and just two others in the country, that have said that these predatory lenders need to be investigated and prosecuted, not negotiated with and settled with.
Well, as you know, Mr. Schneiderman, our Attorney General, is being basically not only lobbied by the Obama administration to stop his lawsuit against the big banks, but other Attorney Generals are isolating him, dropping him from the nationwide effort of Attorney Generals to fight back against this. So Schneiderman deserves our respect for standing up for people in trouble and against the banks. And I think that, you know, in some ways, without perhaps wanting to be, Mary Lee Ward has become a symbol of that battle, a symbol of that fight for people to stay in their homes. And I want to thank you, Karen, for standing with her. Give us the information again where people can come on Wednesday.
On Wednesday, please come join the march led by Mary Lee Ward to support our Attorney General, 4 p.m., 320 Tompkins Avenue, Tompkins and Gates in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. You could take the G train to Bedford and Ostrand. We need people to join this fight. Like you said, Mary Lee Ward is the face of this fight, but this is a fight against all illegal foreclosures and evictions and against all fraudulent predatory lenders. So please join us.
Would you like to say anything to the people before we go, Ms. Ward?
Ms. Ward, can you just say just one final quote, anything that you want to say to the people?
Well, I want to speak out for all the people that's not able to do it. And these 18 years that I've been fighting, I praise Jehovah God through Jesus Christ to give me the strength to keep on fighting for myself and all the ones that's not able to do it. And I want to say to each and every one that pretty soon, dignity for all
There you go. That's Mary Lee Ward.
There you go. Dignity for All, Mary Lee Ward on News Dissector Radio today. She's 82. She's a fighter. She's fighting in Brooklyn, and people are fighting with her, and that's a wonderful thing. Now we're switching tack a little bit here about another group of people who are fighting for truth and for survival that you probably didn't know about or haven't been following, and it's extremely important because even though the Vietnam War ended 1975 with a, you know, a liberation, if you will, of Saigon by the Vietnamese people, they inherited a country that had been torn apart in large part by chemical weapons, by Agent Orange and the like. And just recently, this summer, there was a conference in Hanoi, Vietnam, the capital of Vietnam, now the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, saying basically that, calling on the world to help the people of Vietnam who are suffering from this Agent Orange and the like. So we want to basically hear more about it. And joining us now is Fred Wilcox. Fred is up at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. He's written a beautiful book, I have to say, Fred, Scorched Earth, Legacies of Chemical Warfare in Vietnam. It's coming out from Seven Stories Press this next month, but it's not just a scientific account. It's a very well-written and well-argued account about what's happened to the people in Vietnam. Would you like to summarize it for us, and then let's discuss it?
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for your kind remarks, your comments. The book attempts to tell the world, or people who read it, about the tragedy in Vietnam, and the tragedy of chemical warfare, the legacies of chemical warfare. That is to say that all these years after, as you mentioned, the fall of Saigon, after the last spray mission in Vietnam, people there, they have about 3 million Vietnamese people who are suffering from Agent Orange exposure. And
3 million,
and about 500 children. You have to just see these children with the armless and legless and retarded and huge heads and blind to feel the whole tragedy, because it's just, you know, what do these children do? What did they do to anybody to deserve this fate? It's a great tragedy.
You know, the Vietnamese basically have said, Dr. Tan Tat Tung, who's a Vietnamese research scientist, you quote him as saying, in the abominable history of war, with the sole exception of nuclear weapons, never has such an inhuman fate ever before been reserved for the survivors. And he's talking now about his own people in Vietnam. A decade of chemical warfare, you're right, had reduced majestic triple canopy jungles to toxic graveyards, mangrove forests, habitats of songbirds, and vital to coastal ecosystems had been turned into eerie moonscapes. Agent Orange, the most widely used herbicide in Vietnam, was named after the orange stripe painted around the 55-gallon barrels in which it was stored. And this toxic chemical, this lethal chemical, was dumped by the barrelful on the people of Vietnam. And just this past August, the second International Conference of Victims of Agent Orange Dioxin was held in Hanoi from August 8th to 9th, 2011. To my knowledge, it was not reported on anywhere in the American media, although the American government, clearly the American military, is responsible for the problem. The conference is a significant and important historic event marking the 50th anniversary of the first spraying of the toxic chemical Agent Orange by U.S. forces in Vietnam and Indochina. And so, Fred, you know, you're dealing with a story that people really don't want to hear about. You know, the war is over. You know, we lost or we won or whatever we think happened. But we don't want to hear about the damage that we caused. And I think this type of denial is something that you're fighting, and others like myself are fighting and trying to get people to remember this issue, because I reported from Vietnam. I was in Hanoi, and I heard about all of this. And we visited, you know, victims of all of this, and we met doctors and nurses who are struggling, you know, to help the victims. And this was back in 74, and it hasn't stopped, has it?
No, it hasn't stopped at all, and that's why I call it such a great tragedy, because the Vietnamese are very frightened. They don't know when this thing will end, if it ever will end, because they're now seeing the third and fourth generation of children whose mothers or fathers were exposed to Agent Orange. And then they're, you know, they get married and they have children, their children are deformed, they grow up and then they have children and their children are deformed. So, it's an ongoing, thing. It's very, very, very scary. Everybody you talk to in Vietnam, well, I mean, about the Agent Orange issue, this is the thing that frightens them the most, is that future generations are going to continue to be, harmed, by these chemicals. Dioxin, that is, TCDD dioxin, is the most toxic molecule known to man. And we sprayed about 20 million gallons, of Agent Orange in Vietnam over an area of about 5 million acres. So we saturated some areas, like Da Nang and Pleiku, certain areas there where scientists go over, even now, they go over and they take soil samples or food samples or blood samples from people, and they find dioxin. They find dioxin in the food, in the water, in the blood of Vietnamese or fatty tissues of the Vietnamese. So this stuff is just, the longevity of dioxin is just remarkable.
And it's also affected Americans, Fred, as you point out in your book, that there have been scientists releasing well-researched studies on the effects of Agent Orange dioxin on human beings. Among them, to quote from your book, researchers conducting a mortality study for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts conclude that the results suggest that Vietnam veterans may be at increased risk of death due to soft tissue, sarcoma, kidney cancer, suicide, motor vehicle accidents, and strokes compared to non-veterans. And a lot of this has to do with their exposure to these dioxins. Now, the Vietnamese and supporters in America have attempted to get damages from the American government. What's happened to that effort? How is it possible that, despite all this evidence, somehow this whole case has been sort of dismissed? Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, that's a remarkable question. It's a remarkable answer. In Scorched Earth, my book, I have a whole chapter, long chapter, called The Realm, about the legal aspects of the Agent Orange suit. Of course, the first class action suit was on behalf of Vietnam veterans, our veterans. That was settled out of court. Veterans call it a sellout. I've always called it a sellout, not a settlement, for $180 million. In other words, the chemical companies that manufactured Agent Orange got off pretty free. They were pretty happy about that. They broke out the champagne in 1983 when that class action was settled. Then the Vietnamese have tried. They went to court in 2004. I was actually in the courtroom. Great travesty. The same judge that ruled against the Vietnam veterans ruled against the Vietnamese. Saying, he said at the time, there's just no evidence. Well, that's amazing. That's what the chemical companies say. There's just no evidence that dioxin and Agent Orange harms human beings. There's a mountain of evidence. There's an absolute mountain, and the mountain is growing bigger.
Let's name that judge, if we could. Jack Weinstein.
His name is Weinstein. Jack Weinstein, yeah.
Right, and this judge supposedly is a progressive judge.
Well, he has been made some good decisions about guns, handguns, and other things like that. Yeah, he's supposed to be a progressive judge. I'll tell you, Danny, the more you read about the legal aspects, the more that's really quite frightening, too, because if the veterans and the Vietnamese can't prove, if they couldn't prove their lawsuit, then none of us can. See, we're all being exposed to toxic chemicals, to dioxin and PCBs and radiation, all kinds of things. And our children are dying, our friends are dying, we're getting sick. 45% of American males will get cancer, something like 40%, 38% of women will get. So it's an epidemic. You know, cancer is an epidemic in this country. And what I keep trying to tell people about this whole tragedy is, you know, we can ignore the Vietnamese, we can ignore Vietnam veterans, but we're ignoring ourselves. You know, we're ignoring the fact that our environment is being trashed, you know, poisoned by chemical companies, the same companies, many of them, that that poisoned Vietnam.
Now, you went to Vietnam as investigating this for your book. You're a veterans advocate, an environmentalist. You've been a scholar on the Vietnam War for the past 30 years. And so you go there, and what happens? You go and meet these people, and what do you learn?
Well, what you learn is what you've read about, and what you see is absolutely shocking. You go into a place like the Friendship Village that was established by George Mizo and a couple other people. George was a combat Vietnam veteran, went back to Vietnam, wanted to do something for people there, particularly Agent Orange victims. And you see the children, and you see these beautiful children. I mean, they're just gorgeous, but they are missing legs, or they're missing hands, or they're lying in a crib with a gigantic watermelon-sized head, or they're sitting in a crib with only half of a body. And so when you see this, the question I will end up asking is, if this is, Agent Orange is not responsible for this, then tell me what is. Tell me what made these children this way. And it's very clear, anybody I think who goes over there and wanders around as I did, Hanoi, Da Nang, Ho Chi Minh City, Coochie, you'll see these children and other people, you'll see other human beings, and you'll just have to ask yourself, my God, what happened to these people? And the answer to me is, well, they were exposed, or the parents were exposed to this toxic chemical called dioxin, and so they were born this way. You'll see perfectly beautiful Vietnamese children, but they're retarded. They're seriously retarded. And the other thing that happens over there, sometimes these parents who are scared to death, but they have children, and the child will be seem to be perfectly okay, and then they get to maybe 9 or 10 or a little older, and suddenly they just can't talk, they can't walk, they can't, you know, their whole, they just deteriorate, and it's absolutely horrifying. It's heartbreaking. I took my son with me. He's the one who took the photographs in the book, and you know, he was just overwhelmed.
You went into an evidence room that they've maintained there of evidence,
yeah,
on this. What's that like?
Well, that's just entering the Chamber of Horrors. There are shelves and shelves and shelves there of, the Vietnamese call them monsters. I'm not being ridiculing the children, but these are fetuses that have two heads, or, you know, they're glued together, Siamese twins, missing brains, missing eyes, all sorts of things. As a doctor, his name is Dr. Fong, and Dr. Fong has been doing the research on this for 30 years. She was a young doctor in Saigon Hospital in 1968, and she delivered this baby that was so seriously deformed. It was just a horrible mess, and she hid it. She hid the baby from the mother because she said she just could not tell this mother, show this mother what she had given birth to. So,
how do people cope with this? Because, you know, not only to cope with the realities of all of these physical, you know, issues and mental issues and your own deterioration as you are exposed to it and totally get depressed by your inability to do anything about it, but the indifference, if you will, of the rest of the world, the people who know about this and who have remained silent all these years, who just want it to be over. And, you know, at this conference in Vietnam, they passed a resolution. It said, we ask all of humanity, all governments, organizations, and individuals, whatever their social or political position, to take immediate action to support all victims of Agent Orange, with particular emphasis of those in Vietnam. In every country and in every region, we should set up organizations and develop specific programs for mobilizing material resources, whatever form possible, to help the Vietnamese Agent Orange victims in their struggle for justice. Now, this is
right.
a basic, you know, demand, a cry, if you will, from the victims of Vietnam, and yet, You know, their conference wasn't even reported. One of the things in your book, that in addition to the scientific evidence and your reporting and the storytelling, the pictures by your son, which are really very striking, there are letters from Agent Orange victims. Do you have your book there by any chance?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If you could go to page 172, the top of it, and just, you know, read one of these, and I'll read one as well, because this is the testimony that I don't know if Jack Weinstein has a heart or if he's in the pocket totally of the chemical companies, but and the U.S. government, which doesn't want a fair settlement. Just read that for us, if you will, for me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Danny. I don't have a copy.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, I have my, so it doesn't paginate.
All right. Well, let me tell you. Yeah. I'll read it then. For me, I have been infected directly with Agent Orange. Poor eyesight. Losing most of my lower jaw's teeth. Two loose teeth, often getting ill. Gastrectomy of 3/4 of my stomach. Gangrene of 40 millimeters of my testimony. Thumatic limbs. My wife is in panic when seeing such a husband and children. Therefore, she has a mental illness. Sometimes she doesn't know what she's doing. This is from Lee Kwang Chung from Trinh La Hamlet. And then there's this letter here from the Wang Trinh Commune. Okay. Dear Professor Kenneth Herman, my name is Tran T. Lan. I was born and raised in Trufang Quang Tri. I visited Quang Tri, by the way, when I was in Vietnam. This area was mercilessly destroyed by chemical warfare during the American War. That's what they call it. My daughter is 2 years old, but she cannot speak or sit up. Her head is getting bigger while her muscles are getting smaller. Our life is very difficult. We have to live off of my parents and my neighbors. So these are the testimonies of actual people, real people, who are experiencing all of this outside of our whole media system, where we're totally unaware of it all. And I want to, you know, thank you, Fred Wilcox, for taking the time and making the effort, not just now, but over the years, to keep these issues alive and to share this information with the people who are willing to find it. Fred, I mean, this is really important work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, it's important to the American people because, as I said before, you know, our environment is poison, too, and we have a cancer epidemic here. So my message always is ignore the Vietnamese, but it's at our own peril if we don't look at them and show compassion.
Yeah, I want to thank, you know, Adelaide Park Gomer for turning me on to this book, one of your colleagues up in Ithaca, who's also being a staunch fighter for truth, to get this information out there, and I really appreciate it. So thank you, Fred Wilcox, the book Scorched Earth, the publisher, Seven Stories Press. Really read this, because even if you think you know this story, you won't be able to put it down. I'm telling you, it's really gripping. So we're coming to the end here this week, and we have, like, you know, Cat in the studio, we have DJ in the studio, we have a lot to talk about. We have a hurricane coming to New York. We had an earthquake last week, which I felt in my study. My desk started shaking. I got like a little you know, dizzy, you know, from it. So I know that it happened and could happen again. We're in a world which is very volatile. Everything is sort of unplanned and unexpected, and yet it seems to be happening with a kind of rapidity. And that's why I think it's important to pay attention to all of this. You can write to me at danny@mediachannel.org. You can find the podcast of this radio program on Progressive Radio Network.com. I'm going to post it in my blog. I've been off this week, sort of on my own version of a media fast. I must be honest with you, I haven't been fasting enough, but I certainly haven't been doing my blog. I'm going to come back to it next Monday at newsdissector.com, and you'll be able to get the URL for this radio show as well. And I hope that you'll stay with us on this program in the weeks to come. I want to end with another event that's coming up in New York. It's, of course, 9/11. The whole preparations for it are starting. There are going to be endless events and tributes and attempts to exploit all of this to continue the kind of, if you will, the war on terror, the GWAT, the great war on terror that the Bush administration started and that the Obama administration has continued. But I want to play something for you, which grew out of a project that I worked on with many others called We Are Family. The idea was this was not just an attack on America or on Americans, but it was an attack on everybody. Because we are a family, we have to think of ourselves that way. We have to think of ourselves not just as a nation state. We have to show tolerance and respect for all of our people. And this collage was put together based on the song We Are Family by my buddy Polarity One, Polar Levine, called We Are Family. We're going to go out with that today.
I fell to the floor screaming out. I couldn't believe what was going on in my city. I'm screaming at the top of my lungs.
And reflect and know that forever this planet will be changed.
It was madness.
This is unbelievable to me.
Catastrophic. We're all at risk, you know. Catastrophic.
Somebody coming out of the blue and taking somebody else's life away is something we cannot accept.
It's changed everything. It's changed everything.
We have over 1,500 children who have lost at least one parent.
That's deep. That's real deep.
We have
I swear to you, it was like being punched in the stomach with the force of like a tree trunk or something.
I refuse to hang on to despair.
Boom. I feel like we were virgins and we just got gang raped. I mean, really, it feels bad, you know, traumatic.
We as a nation have been so sheltered from this kind of pain for so long.
Such a violent act is beyond what I can understand.
I gotta help. I wanna go help. I have to help.
We're just a bunch of musicians.
We are family.
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 My family is comfortable, and your family is comfortable. I don't have any fear that your family's going to attack mine.
I've never seen people so united, so together, so helpful, so supportive.
Just because someone looks Swahili does not mean that they're Islamic, terrorist, or whatever.
Make sure that they make the difference between fanatic Muslims and Muslims.
He attacked us because we look different.
We're all the same. We are all the same.
Yes, we are family.
A family that really appreciates one another, love, share, and are giving of one another as a family.
What could cure America as a wounded country?
You're coming out here with a party record, a celebration. Does our country need that now? Does the world need that now?
Yes.
We are family.